So tonight we're going to do the third of this series of three talks on the seven factors of awakening. And so tonight we're going to talk about the final three. So let's just very quickly review. Remember, we had mindfulness, which was the basis for everything, and everything, all the rest of them require mindfulness to be there. Then we had investigation of dhammas, energy, and pithy, joyful interest, intense interest. So these were called those three were called the arousing factors. They stimulate us. If we're not careful, we get overstimulated. And so the final three, prasati, which usually gets translated as something like tranquility, samadhi, which is concentration, and upekkha, which is equanimity, are called the calming factors. So they level things out. We have all that energy from the arousing factors, and then there's this shift into a calmer space. But those arousing factors have to be there for these calming factors to arise. Remember, this is a cumulative process. So let's look at these. The first one is, I mentioned, was prasadi, usually translated as tranquility, but other translations I've seen are simply calm, serenity, and composure. And the last two point to the fact that this is much more than just physical calm. This is much more mental. There is a physical aspect to it, but it's really about having a mind that's unruffled, I think would be a thing. It's also like an emotional calmness. We can sit and things arise that might normally hook us, and it's like they just don't have that power anymore. They don't grab us anymore. We're calm, we're still, we're tranquil, and these strong emotional mind, mental factors, mental arisings, unpleasant emotional things, whatever, really pleasant emotional things for that matter, arise and they're not compelling. We don't sort of jump on the train. We can be aware of them. We're mindful of them, but they don't grip us. This is also sometimes thought of as the antidote to restlessness and worry. That agitated, can't sit still mentally, physically. When prasadi is there, that energy just doesn't arise. It isn't there. It's like the opposite, in some sense, of tranquility. And even though this is part mainly a mental factor, there's also a strong physical correlate that's always going to be there as well. If prasadi has arisen, the body will be very still. In fact, the body might start to sort of fade away in terms of our awareness of it. The edges of things aren't going to be so clear. I've heard stories of, and had very minor experiences of, people who actually don't feel any body at all at this point. The body is now, you're in a purely mental process. The flip side is also true, of course. If we can consciously keep the body still, then it's more likely that prasadi can arise. So this is why stillness of posture is so strongly emphasized. I mean, in some traditions, it's really like, if you're sitting zazen and you move, you get hit with a stick. Well, I don't recommend that. But consciously sort of setting the intention to be still when you sit, as still as you can possibly be. Often when you do that, and when Posadi's there, your breath is barely perceptible. That's usually a sign that Posadi is, you're in the territory of Posadi. With like, you're noting, you're being mindful, and you notice that the breath is there, but it's so subtle. It's almost like, where'd my breath go? It's still there, but it's like it's way, way in the background, with almost no physical sensations at all. I mean, you also are still breathing, otherwise you'd fall over, right? So, but it's like extremely subtle. Also, when Posadi is present, you won't have any body tension. You'll feel very sort of like just relaxed. Not to the like kick back and who cares level, but just everything is it's your body softens because there's no restlessness and worry. It's like the opposite. It's like you're still, you're calm, and the body gets very sort of gentle and relaxed. But what about when we're not sitting? It's pretty hard to be perfectly still when we're not sitting, right? The most important thing I've heard about this, and I know that people achieve all seven of these mental factors in walking practice as well as sitting practice, is for Posadi to be cultivated, you really need to consciously choose to slow down. When we're doing like day-long retreats and we're alternating between walking practice and sitting practice, as one example, the gong goes, and you don't need to leap up. You don't need to rush off to make sure you get that good walking space, which is I've been there. Oh, I better get going because someone will take that good walking space. I've found myself doing that. It's okay to just like be really slow. Just sort of, okay, I'm going to go, I'm starting walking practice and I'm noting my steps, but I don't have to go fast. And just in our regular daily life, you do your daily sitting practice. And especially if you do it in the morning, the temptation is then to sort of, oh, I finished my sitting practice. Now I better get my act together. And you start rushing around to get your act together, right? Get to work, take care of the baby, make your breakfast, da 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 da, all those things you got to do, right? And it's really important if you sit in the morning to just allow yourself, once you stop the formal sitting practice and you're slowly getting up, to get up really slowly. Even if it's just for like an extra minute, just ease into things. And this will preserve this calm energy much more strongly. It's also, on the mental level, there's a total absence of any desire for anything else. It's like just this energy, this mental space of calm, still serenity. Who needs anything? Right? It's like, what else could I want? Right? It's really, that's what it feels like. It's like there's no sense of wanting anything at all. No sense of needing anything more than is there right now. I'll read a little bit from Joseph here. And he's talking about, in this particular quote, he's talking about the fact that Sometimes when people are looking at the enlightenment factors, these factors of awakening, this particular factor, Pasati, sort of doesn't get glossed over, but it's sort of like, the poor handmaiden of the others. In particular, of piti and then concentration, samadhi. It's like, whoa, those are the real cool, sexy ones, right? And calm is like, well, yes, it'll be there too. And he makes this, it's very clear here. Although the Buddha laid out this progression so clearly, the enlightenment factor of calm is frequently overshadowed by its jazzier neighbors, rapture and concentration. In looking back at my own practice, I've seen that I often give more emphasis to the development of concentration. However, this is sometimes accompanied by a kind of striving and efforting that actually gets in the way. In other words, that factor of not wanting anything isn't there. Isn't that interesting, huh? In my efforts to concentrate, I may sometimes unknowingly practice desire and the wanting mind, which is exactly what hinders concentration. It is worth remembering that the quality of calm has the precise function of cooling out this desiring mind. As tranquility develops, desire is abandoned. And it is this tranquility that allows for concentration, the next factor of awakening, to naturally arise. So he's pointing to this not wanting anything, not sort of like striving at all, just being in this calm, tranquil, still, serene space leads to the openness to deeper concentration, which is the next factor, right? Remember, all these factors are dependent on all the other ones. If we sort of gloss over this, like, oh, this is nice, but really, concentration is where it's at. I better get going on concentration. We lose what's there. In another place in his commentaries, he also says we have to be very careful, much like piti, only different, because this is a different, very different kind of pleasantness. Remember, we talked about piti as being very sort of pleasant and exciting, and sometimes we get stuck in like trying to reproduce that. Well, this Pasadi's like that too, only it's the flip side. It's like, it's really sweet just to sort of be there in this calm, still space, not wanting anything, being perfectly still, physically and mentally. It's extremely pleasant. And once again, we can get caught in the, oh, now I got it. This is where I got to the end of this, right? No, sorry. There's two more factors we got to deal with here. So it's a thought we have to pay attention to. So that's Pasati. Then comes Samadhi. So I want to point out it's in Pali, the word Samadhi has a different meaning than you'll see in Sanskrit. So if you're familiar with the Sanskrit version of the word Samadhi, be careful because they're talking about different things here. So in Sanskrit, samadhi has this flavor of knowing everything. In Pali, samadhi strictly has to do with concentration. Little sidebar there. So, and basically, what concentration is this state of mind that is steady and one-pointed. So not only is the mind calm, there's a steadiness that it's palpable. I want to read a couple of things here. This is from Joseph's book, The Experience of Insight. And he's talking about concentration. There are two kinds of concentration. One is developed by focusing on any single object and developing concentration to the point of absorption into it. This kind of one-pointedness becomes the basis of many psychic powers. Sounds great, huh? The other form of concentration, the kind used for the development of insight, is called momentary concentration. It is the mind that is steady and one-pointed on changing objects. It is this kind of concentration which, in conjunction with all the other factors of enlightenment, leads to freedom. So there's these two flavors, I suppose you could call it, of concentration. One that is focused on a particular meditative object. You see this also in things like visualization practices, mantra practices. These are all concentration practices. And within this tradition, you see this when people focus on simply the breath. And everything else is, no, I'm just going to reject everything else. I'm just going to focus on the breath, which is both a beginner practice and a very advanced practice when you go deeper into it. As opposed to, quote, traditional mindfulness, where all we're trying to do is note what's most prominent in our experience at a particular moment, and then waiting 3 or 4 seconds, and then noting the next thing, and the next thing, and the next thing. So it's concentrated, but it's a moving form of concentration. What we're concentrating on, the object of concentration, keeps changing based on what's most prominent in our experience at the time. Also, in both forms, and this is from my own personal experience, in both forms of concentration, this leads to mental states called jhanas. Traditionally, they talk about four of them, which are progressive levels. And these are just deeper and deeper states of concentration, where, and you can find all kinds of things written about them. I'm not going to talk about them a lot. But the main thing is that when you shift, it's the only way I can describe it, when you shift from just concentration to a jhana state, all obstacles, all the kilesas are gone. Just not there. So it's kind of interesting because all the things that we normally think of as obstacles to our practice, those don't exist when we're in that mind state. And because of this, of course, these mind states can once again be quite seductive because they're so pleasant. I mean, not having any kilesas, how pleasant could that be, right? And so, once again, we have to be aware of this and be careful with it. So, what are forms of concentration practice that we have talked about, or I talk about and teach at various times? The two that come most to mind is using the breath, but if you really want to concentrate using the breath, you can start counting the breath, choosing to count the breath. But the way I was taught is you count backwards from 10. And when I ask, well, why backwards? And it says, well, it takes a little more concentration to keep track of where you are, because we don't normally walk around talking back, counting backwards, unless you're a rocket scientist, I suppose. The rest of us all, move forward with when we're counting. So you'd be working with the breath, and you'd be noting in, out, and then you'd note 10. In, out, 9. And you just keep counting until you got to 1, and then you just start again, back at 10. And if you lost any, if somewhere in the middle, it's like, in, out, gee, I think it's 6, or not, you start at 10 again. Just go back. It's an interesting way to practice. If you're, I find I use this sometimes when I'm sort of kind of agitated when I'm sitting, like I'm physically agitated in particular. It's really, for me, it's been a great antidote to agitation, just to sort of make myself concentrate that much more. Just, okay, let's just really slow down and really tune into the breath and use this counting as a way of sort of reminding me that that's what I'm doing in a sense. It's just another skillful means. The other one, of course, is metta practice, where metta is a deep concentration practice as well, because we have to sort of keep those four phrases going along with the visualization of the person we're offering the metta to and a sense of the meaning of the phrases for that particular person. So it's a lot to concentrate on there. The flip side, vipassana, mindfulness, whatever, the different words we use. The big issue I've found around mindfulness practice, the concentration part of that, of being able to concentrate on a changing object, is we get caught, if we're not careful, thinking, oh, I'm thinking. That's a problem. And thinking isn't a problem. This may be news to some of you, but it's like thinking is just a natural occurrence that arises. And if we can be aware that we're thinking, not getting caught by the content so much as just we're calm, we're still, we're aware that this thought or this series of thoughts or this story or whatever is running. And at the same time, be totally mindful of it. It's just another thing. This is what's prominent now. This is what I'm paying attention to. Eventually, it'll go away, as we all know. Joseph has some interesting things to say about this, too, of course. And this is a whole section in his book called Working with Thoughts That Arise in the Mind. I think it's really interesting. In any discussion of concentration, an important issue that arises is how to relate to the many thoughts that arise in the mind. There are different ways of working with thoughts, depending in part on whether we're practicing a fixed object concentration, aiming for full absorption, or engaging in momentary concentration, which develops one pointedness on changing objects. So if you're doing something like just breath, counting the breath, metta, then when thoughts arise, we just say, no, we're not going to do that, and go back to our single one-pointed object. On the other hand, in the first, as the name implies, the idea is to keep the mind steady on a fixed object. So anything that else that arises is seen as a distraction. Here we either ignore or simply let go of whatever arises and come back again and again to the object of meditation. In insight practice, on the other hand, where we use momentary concentration to investigate changing objects, there is a different attitude of mind with regard to thoughts. This is what Sayadaw Tenjaniya has said about this. When the mind is thinking or wandering, just be aware of it. Thinking is a natural activity of the mind. You are doing well if you are aware that the mind is thinking. But if you feel disturbed by thoughts, or if you have a reaction or judgment to them, there is a problem with your attitude. Not a problem that you're having thoughts. It's a problem with your attitude towards having the thoughts. The wandering mind is not a problem. Your attitude that they should not be around is the problem. So understand that if you have just become aware of some functions of the mind, these two are just objects for your attention. Thinking is a mental activity. When you're new to this practice, you should not try to watch thinking continuously. Neither should you try to avoid observing thoughts by immediately going to your primary meditation object. When you realize that you are thinking, always pay attention to the thought first, and then remind yourself that a thought is just a thought. A thought is just a thought. Do not think of it as my thought. Now you can return to your primary meditation object. When you feel disturbed by the thinking mind, Remind yourself that you're not practicing to prevent thinking, but rather to recognize and acknowledge thinking whenever it arises. If you are not aware, you cannot know that you are thinking. The fact that you recognize that you are thinking means you are aware. Remember that it does not matter how many times the mind thinks, wanders off, or gets annoyed about something, as long as you become aware of it. It's just like a different vibe, a different attitude towards thoughts. I remember when I first started practice, I actually thought at one point that meditation practice was about learning how to stop thinking. Good luck with that one, right? It took me a while to figure that out, but it was like, now you can't stop thinking. It's like, you stop thinking, you're probably dead, basically. It's not how that works. So you don't want to work on that one. It's just, that's what happens. Oops. Two other things I want to mention. Concentration is based on sila. Oh, here we are back at the very beginning of our practice. If we're leading a wholesome life, it's much easier to concentrate. Because if we're not, if we're sort of, we have these sort of little niggling worries and regrets all the time, that's what's going to be there, and we're going to get caught by them. And we're not going to be able to concentrate. You know, this is the bliss of blamelessness, as the Buddha calls it, really does assist in allowing us to concentrate more deeply. There's all these places in the sutta where the Buddha, lays out some sequence of things that lead to enlightenment. They all begin with sila. And somewhere near the end, they get the concentration. But without sila, you'll never get the concentration. And there's one other thing. This is once again from Joseph. And he's saying here, impurities of thoughts. Oh, wait, but there are such things as impurities of thought. It is interesting to reflect on what impurities means in terms of our practice. Some aspects of the word are obvious, like wrong actions of body and speech, and unwholesome thoughts of greed, ill will, and cruelty. But the Buddha also spoke of subtler impurities, such as being lost in worldly thoughts of family and friends, or of reputation, of work. As lay people living in the world, we do not need to think about these things sometimes. But very often, we're simply lost in the kind of unnoticed reverie about them, drifting along in habits of thought that may not be particularly unwholesome, but may be inappropriate or unnecessary for the task at hand. Are they necessary? Probably not. So that's sometimes when you get caught, and this is one I struggle with. Thinking, I got to get this done and that done today. And then I'm, quote, meditating in my morning practice. And what I'm doing is thinking about all the things I got to get done that day, or one particular thing. And it's another one of those places where you can pop a little thought into the mind that simply just says, is this necessary? And if you look at what you're thinking about, it's like, well, until you actually are doing whatever you're thinking about doing later, you're not thinking about it isn't going to get it done any quicker or anything like that. It's just, better to just be mindful of doing it while you're doing it and let the rest go. Is it necessary to do this right now? And often, you go, oh, yeah, this is not necessary at all. And then Joseph goes on. An even subtler level of impurity is when we're lost in Dharma thoughts about our practice and different meditative states. These thoughts are so seductive precisely because they are about the Dharma. And as with worldly thoughts, there are times when conscious, mindful Dharma reflection can be a big help on the path. But we're simply lost in Dharma reveries or in judgments about our practice. That's the one, the big one. They are not particularly helpful. Judging our practice, am I doing this right? Am I good enough? Am I progressing? Blah, blah, blah. All those things are just impediments. You know, it's just practice. So that's the ideas presented about concentration. And finally, we get to equanimity. Upekkha. And before I go far into this, I want to point something out. In some translations, you'll see the word upekkha or upeksham, which is the Sanskrit word for it, translated not as equanimity, but as indifference. And indifference is different than equanimity. Indifference is, eh, I don't care. Equanimity is, I'm right here in the moment, paying precise attention, like my whole heart is wide open. It's a very different mental formation. Indifference is an unwholesome mind state. You know, or it can be. So it's just be careful when you read translations of things. The equanimity is much, much more than indifference. The difference being, they're both in the not being caught up in the world, but indifference is sort of a shutting out of the world, and equanimity is opening to the world. So it's a different direction. And so equanimity, you get this, you know, it's called then sometimes translated simply as an evenness of mind. And the mind is even, steady, still, concentrated. All those other factors are present. And then equanimity is there. Not thrown off by wild elation or unpleasant depressions or whatever. It's like those things just don't affect you. When you're in equanimity, you're not affected by what's arising at the level of mind at all. It's just that's what's there, and you're noting it, paying attention to it, you're aware of it, but it doesn't affect you. You're not grabbed by it. You're not hooked by it. You're not trying to do something about it. You're just being aware of it. And this is sort of the end point of the practice. If we can, remember, this is number seven, this is the last factor of awakening, right? The interesting thing is when you look at other teachings of the Buddha, you know, the four Brahma Viharas and the 10 Paramis, which are also famous teachings, the last thing on both of those lists is equanimity. So the Buddha keeps coming back to everything leads to equanimity. It's interesting in that sense. The trouble with equanimity is it's hard to imagine. I mean, what does it mean? What's it like to be equanimous, right? And I said it was not affected by things that are arising. So there is this teaching within this, the ideas of equanimity called the 8 worldly vicissitudes. You know, 8 things, 8 worldly things that we get that cause us problems. You don't hear the word vicissitudes very often, so it's an interesting word. And these are in pairs. So I just want to sort of talk about these pairs and see and where this is, because they help us understand what having an equanimous mind really means. So first of all, we're not affected by gain and loss. Often thought of in purely physical terms, like gain getting good stuff and not getting and lo or losing good stuff, you know, gain and loss in that sense. But it's very relevant to our practice. You know, we have what we think of as a good sit, and we think we've gained something. Ah, I figured something out. Then the next sit, or the next day, or the next week, we have a bad sit, and we think we've lost something, and we try to figure out what went wrong. Both those are just the mind being caught in comparing. I gained something, I lost something. Nah, this is just life flowing along. Sometimes the mind is still and calm, and sometimes you sit and it's a train wreck, and this is the way it is. You know, what we think when we have a good sit, we've gained something, we've figured something out. And when we've had a bad sit, that we must be doing something wrong. I love it in Joseph's book, there's a place where he says, sometimes the only thing you can note is is chaos. That's his entire note, chaos. Because that's what's going on at the moment in his mind. Chaos. It's not a bad sit if you're aware that that's what's going on. Perfectly good sit. You know, judging our sits as good or bad, it's just a way of beating ourselves up and puffing ourselves up. Oh, aren't I so great? I had a good sit. Or, oh my God, what's wrong with me? I had a bad sit. No, you just sat. The fact that you sat means it's a good sit. End of discussion. So I like to think of it. Then comes praise and blame. Another pair. It's so easy to get caught up in feeling good about praise and feeling bad about blame. And both reactions just create more self. You get praise, oh, I'm so wonderful. In another place, oh, this person's saying all these bad things about me. I must be. Either I'm really upset because he's being really mean to me, or she's being really mean to me, or they don't know what they're talking about. We get wound, right? This is just words. Just words. There's a place in the Dhammapada where the Buddha goes to his, sometimes people praise you. Sometimes people, blame you. Sometimes people ignore you completely. And all three of them, we react to these things. And none of them are relevant at all. They're just what other people think. That's all. Nothing to do with who you are or where you are in the world. But you think about our culture and how it leans so heavily on praise and blame, on how important it is. And it's not like, and you have to be careful here, like someone praises you. You don't want to sort of discount it or go, oh, no, I'm not like that. Because you are. I mean, obviously, they see something in you and they praise you for it. So you say thank you. But can you do the same thing when someone blames you? You really did that wrong, but oh, thank you. If you can have the same response to both praise and blame, then we're doing okay. Then we're in the territory of equanimity. Then we have, fame and disrepute, which is like my notes here, I wrote down praise and blame writ large. Like we are famous, you're someone who's famous, or you're someone who's being in disrepute. These are both can be, if we're not careful, very upsetting. But all those thoughts of blame and those thoughts of how famous you are, just thoughts in other people's minds. It's all they are. It's not relevant to anything. It's just, but here our culture really, it's like everybody's supposed to have their 15 minutes of fame, right? And we get caught in this place. I mean, I've got caught here more than once, in just in little ways, thinking thoughts along the lines of, gee, maybe someone will come to my retreat that knows a famous movie star, and they'll have a good time at the retreat, and they'll tell the movie star, and the movie star will want me to come and teach them. I mean, what nonsense! I mean, total nonsense. But it's like that's That's where the mind goes. I want to be famous in that way. I want to be a movie star's meditation teacher. Who cares? The mind can go there so easily. Wanting that. Or the flip side, I've had people, I actually had someone on one of my retreats, the last day of the retreat, wrote me this really unpleasant note and refused to come to the last night of sitting and wouldn't speak to me as she was leaving, just like, and I just had to read this note and go, okay, this person is unhappy and nothing I can do about this. It was very clear to me there was nothing I could do about it in this, we had like half a day left. It was like on the evening of the last day. And I just let it be, put it away, and just continued on doing what I was doing exactly the same way. Nothing changed. And it was fine. And Lord knows where she ended up. I never heard anything from her ever again. So it's just stuff happens, right? You can't let it affect you. Especially in that sort of situation where I still had 17 other people I had to be teaching. I couldn't just sort of, put everything aside to deal with this situation where it didn't seem like I could do much anyway. The last of the two, the last pair, is pleasure and pain. And when I have little notes here. Changes are inevitable. We get some pleasure and then we get some pain. David Chernikoff talks all the time about the Tao, the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows. And we all want the 10,000 joys and nobody wants the 10,000 sorrows, but we're always going to get some of each. It's just that's the nature of being embodied, being a human being. It's just the cycle of life, perfectly natural, not our fault. Just what is. It's the way things are. We can't give ourselves credit when it's all pleasure, and we can't blame ourselves when it's all pain. Or because it's always a mixture of the two anyway. So the last thing I want to mention is equanimity is one of the things where there's actually a formal practice because it's one of the four Brahma Viharas. And I think it's interesting to look at the statement, like all the Brahma Viharas, they have some statement you repeat over and over again. Right? The statement for equanimity is you are the owner of your karma. Your happiness or happiness depends on your actions, not on my wishes for you. This seems kind of harsh. The first time I heard this, I was like, well, this seems pretty harsh. Because what it's basically saying is, you can't make anyone else happy. You can only, perhaps try to create causes and conditions so that they might be happy. That's the most we can ever do. But to actually, we can't make someone happy. And when we try to make someone happy, we often make them miserable because they sense that we are doing that. And also we make ourselves miserable because we try and make them happy and they don't get happy. What's wrong with them for not seeing how hard I am trying to make them happy? Yeah, have we ever been caught there? It's like it's such a minefield in relationships, this one. We can love someone, we can want the best for them, we can do, as I said, things that potentially might cause happiness to arise in them, but that's all we can ever do. We have enough trouble making ourselves happy, right? Without trying to make everyone else happy. And this is so against our culture, because our culture tells us, it's our job to make other people happy. It's what we're supposed to do. And yeah, I'm supposed to do whatever I can to create causes and conditions so that someone might be happy. But that's all. All I can ever do. The amount of suffering we cause ourselves and others trying to make other people happy is phenomenal. And it also stops us from being happy because we try and it doesn't work. And oh my God, I must have done something wrong. I've done something wrong because I haven't succeeded in making them happy. Fall into these cycles of self-blame and blaming the other. What's wrong with them? I'm doing all this stuff and they're still not happy. It's just a dead end. And it also reflects the truth of things. This is the truth of how things are. Hard to take in, especially for people close to us. But it's to have a good relationship with someone, a truly good relationship, I think this is something we have to understand. That I can't ever make them happy. I can't make them be happy. I can do what I can to maybe have them be happy if they decide to be happy. But it's up to them. It's something we have to absorb, I think. Little summing up. This is from Satipatthana from Analayo. He's talking about this is his the end of his description of the seven factors of awakening. Practically applied, the whole set of the seven awakening factors can be understood to describe the progress of Satipatthana practice to this level of deep equanimity. On the basis of well-established mindfulness, one investigates the nature of subjective reality. Once sustained investigation gains momentum through energy, with producing growing insight, the object of contemplation becomes clearer and the meditator feels inspired to joy to continue with the practice. So there's the arousing factors. If at this point the danger of getting carried away by elation and agitation can be avoided, continued contemplation leads to a state of calmness when the mind stays effortlessly with its meditation object without succumbing to distraction. In other words, concentration has arisen. With maturing insight, this process culminates in a state of firm equanimity and detachment. It is at this point when the inspired momentum of mindful investigation takes place against the background of tranquil composure that the mental equipoise needed for the breakthrough to awakening comes about. At this level of practice, a deep sense of complete letting go prevails. So he's saying that the seven factors of awakening, he's saying it very clearly, are the ground from which an awakening can arise. And remember, awakening doesn't necessarily mean complete awakening, but it does mean really clear insight into the everything into the nature of things. But the factors of awakening create the ground, the mental ground, where that can arise. Or, here's an interesting thought. I've seen this taught actually in on retreats. So teachers have said, well, the progressive idea of the seven factors of awakening, that's just one idea. But you can also look at the seven factors of awakening in a totally different way. And I think this is equally valid. I'm not keen on it, other than it's interesting. And it has some implications in terms of how we actually can mindfully work with our practice. And basically it says, really, mindfulness is like a fulcrum. And sitting on either side of that fulcrum, or on one side are the arousing factors, and on one side are the calming factors. And if, as you're being mindful, you see that the arousing factors are sort of going up and the awakening factors are going down, there's an imbalance, then, oh wait, too much arousing, not enough calming. Let's put a little more focus and energy on concentration on calm. And so you can sort of balance things out. Vice of, but otherwise, you're getting so calm and still, but there's no energy there anymore. You're just calm, which also can occur. Then, oh, I better put some more energy into this. And so you see, it's a way of looking at the factors and going, well, which one should I cultivate in any particular moment? Where should my emphasis be right now in this moment? And you start to sort of balance things so you're always keeping the arousing factors and the calming factors in balance through mindfulness. Notice mindfulness is at the center of it all, because it's what mindfulness allows you to see that this is happening in either direction. Just a totally another way to look at these things that I found useful in my practice sometimes. So it's there are people who would say couldn't possibly be that way. It's got to be sequential, and I understand that. I mean, that's what Analeo just said, for instance. But I think it's useful to be able to see alternative viewpoints sometimes, and just be aware that this is another way of thinking about the factors of awakening. I have a bit of, oh, I probably this is one of the shortest poems you'll ever hear me read. This is from Ryokan, Zen, 17th century Zen monk and poet, and he has these really short, pithy, poetic pieces. The rain has stopped, the clouds have drifted away, and the weather is clear again. If your heart is pure, then all things in the world are pure. Abandon this fleeting world, abandon yourself. Then the moon and the flowers will guide you along the way. Go with the flow, in a sense. I think I'll have the image of the moon and the flowers will guide you along the way. Sometimes Zen poetry can be sort of just right on the line. Anyhow, that's what I have to share this evening.